Okay, so thank you very much for the invitation. So today my talk will be covering some stuff that I've just previously done with David McGady, which is a graduate student at Princeton, and Chong Kao-wen, which is a postdoc at Queen Mary, as well as some recent work that is in progress that should be finished by this month, which involves a new the company, Dan Shea, which is a postdoc at IAS, and Wei-Ming Cheng is a graduate student in Taiwan. So my story really begins in 1982. So at the time, Green, Michael Green, John Schwartz, Lars Rink, and they derived the 4-point amplitudes of maximal super Yang nails from string theory. And the result that they attained was exceedingly simple. It was simply just some kinematic factor times A tree times this box integral. This, by box integral, I mean that these are just scalar propagator, and that's it. And even though there's a lot of different particle species, but the final answer is just extremely simple. And if you integrate it in four dimensions, then this, you just obtain this simple result. So as always, when in physics, when you have something that is very, very simple, the answer that is very simple to a complicated question, you want to know why it's simple. And you also want to know if you can actually see that the answer is very simple and in the beginning. And indeed, if you presented this at the time to Zwiebern, Dixon, Dunbar, and Kausauer, they'll notice that if you actually look at this answer and you look at the branch cut, so we see there's a log factor here, and there's an S-channel and T-channel discontinuity. You can look at the branch cut. We now know from physics, unitarity tells us that the discontinuity has to be given by the product of two tree amplitudes. But if you actually look at all possible branch cuts, you'll actually see that because of the particular tree amplitude that is entering, which is the maximal super Yang-Mills tree amplitude, that the answer is just comparing these two branch cuts, they can uniquely fix that the answer just has to be a box integral just by looking at the branch cut. But the different than the traditional approach is that instead of looking at one branch cut, they want to look at multiple branch cuts. But looking at multiple branch cuts is sufficient to fix the amplitude without using any formal construction. All you need is just the on-shell elements of these 4-point tree amplitudes, and they know the answer is this just by comparing the various branch cuts. So this is the birth of the so-called generalized unitarity. And so this was 30 years ago, and now 30 years afterwards, just for the past year, this has just obviously, as many of you have heard, this has branched out into different topics for this phenomenology application of these approaches for high multiplicity QCD background. On the more formal theory side, there's really been very interesting result. For example, we have now the all loop planar integrand for super Yang Mills. And even beyond just constructing the integrand, people have been able to use this property to just tell you what the integrated answer is. So this is the recent result by Lance Dixon and then his company, where they actually were able to compute the 3 and 4 loop 6-point amplitude without any integrand. All they do is just impose these physical constraints and some knowledge about the symmetries of the theory, and they've been just directly obtained the integrated result. So if I were to summarize really what is the main spirit behind all this, it's basically a factory. So you start from the basic on-shell elements, the non-trivial on-shell elements that you have in your theory. For example, the lowest multiplicity scattering amplitude. And usually this on-shell element is essentially fixed by the symmetry that you already know that your theory should respect, some global symmetries. Then at the next step, you impose locality. What does locality mean here? So as a function of scattering amplitude, locality means that all possible singularity must appear as propagator singularity. Then it represents that your scattering amplitude has singularity that corresponds to a particle that is propagating and it's going on shell. And all the branch cut can only be physical branch cut, meaning that all branch cuts should be in parameters that are essentially these kinematic invariants. And then very end, you just impose unitarity, which tells you that on these residues or on the discontinuity, it has to factorize into lower point elements. And so this is really the simple three-step procedure where it's really lying behind all these recent progress. So in this talk, what I want to do is ask the following. Can we actually use this construction to perturbatively define a general quantum field theory? Instead of, so the idea would be you start out with your asymptotic states, your free representation. That tells you the physical degrees of freedom in your theory. and you impose on it whatever global symmetry you expect that you have, and then just push it through this construction. And does this actually uniquely gives you the final answer? And if so, if this is really a general construction, then it better be applicable where quantum field theories are defined. That means in any dimension. So we want to study this approach in dimensions that are not in four dimensions. We want to go beyond four dimensions. And obviously, in this construction, because all the elements that are entering this discussion are on-shell. They're just on-shell gauge invariant objects. So we really literally just get rid of gauge invariance. There's no more gauge invariance. This is just really, we never ever need gauge invariance. So we know that there's a lot of consistency issues that are imposed by gauge invariance. So now we can ask, actually, whatever happened to those consistency conditions?
Are you restricting yourself to massless particles?
Yes, I'm restricting massless particles. So, but even for massive particles, there's various ways that you can do massive particles that which also fit into this program. One way is to just embed your theory in higher dimension, where you treat the higher dimension momentum as mass, and that depends on what kind of massive theories you want. But yes, I will be focused on massless particles. Now, I will also be focusing on the first part. I will be more focusing on supersymmetric theory.
Yes.
Well, maybe after John Short's paper, that may be something to look at. So the statement there is that yes, I mean a lot of the symmetries that are visible in the conformal fixed point is actually these dual conformal symmetries you can actually extend it to the Coulomb branch. And since now he has some, let me just go on with my talk first. Okay, so let's start with a candidate. So let me just go one dimension down and let me go to three dimension and just see, I'm just going to follow this path and see how far this path can bring me. So first of all, I want to talk about scattering amplitudes. That means I'm talking about a function of some variable. So I want to talk about what variables these are. So since I'm talking about massless, that means all my momentum squared is zero. That means that to solve this condition, usually what we would do is we write this as a bispinner. And so since this p squared is zero, that means that you can write your momentum as just a bispinner. And then the Lorentz invariance just tells you that your scattering amplitude has to be a function of these SL2R invariant brackets. So your function is defined as some SL2R invariant brackets. Now, I want to introduce supersymmetry, so I'm going to introduce some Grassmann variable here that essentially encodes my on-shell states. So for example, this is the states that appear in N equals 6 churn Simon matter theory. So you can see that there's a scalar here, there's three scalars here. There's also a scalar here and three here, so there's eight scalars, and you can see there's eight fermions. But this is just an example of how you use this eta to control what particles you have. Okay, so this is just the introduction of variables. And now I'm just going to say I'm going to be interested in some function of these two variables. So let's begin. So because I'm in three dimension, and in three dimension, three-point kinematics is just totally degenerate. There's no invariance in three-point kinematics. So let me just go to 4-point. Now, I want to impose symmetry. So let's see. So in order to impose symmetry, I better be able to write the symmetry generators using these on-shell variables. So indeed, for example, one of the supersymmetry generator, you can write it as the product of these on-shell variables that are introduced. And because I want to impose a conformal theory a symmetry, so I'm going to just pick out the dilatation operator that looks like this. The reason I didn't list anything else is because actually just these two operators are sufficient to fix my 4-point amplitude. Essentially, all I want is my 4-point amplitude is invariant under the action of the supersymmetry and the dilatation operator. And we can list the solution. It turns out to be unique. So for n equals 8, it's actually very easy to see why it's unique. It's very simple. This is a multiplicative operator. So the only thing that it can vanish under is that it's just you're multiplying it by itself because it's fermionic. So you're just, so you know everything here, your amplitude has to be proportional to these delta functions. You know you're going to have momentum conservation. So all that's left is really fixing the dilatation weight. And since there's really no distinction between different particles, so they have to appear on an equal footing. You see that 4 is missing here, but it's really, really, 4 is really there for momentum conservation. So up to momentum conservation and sine, these are the unique answer for different supersymmetry. So that's just fixed. Now you can look at this a little bit closer. You'll notice that if I exchange any two particle, any two lines, you'll get a minus sign. So this is totally antisymmetric. So that tells you that if there's a theory that describes this interaction, this theory better have a totally antisymmetric structure constant. And indeed, we know that this is exactly what BLG told us, that when they constructed n equals 8 Chern-Simon matter theory, they realized that you actually have to introduce this whole three algebra structure where the three algebra is based on this four-index totally antisymmetric tensor. You can see that this is not really a requirement of gauge symmetry or anything. This is really just on show. You just impose these two conditions, and this just comes out of it. Your gauge information if you just directly comes out by imposing symmetries. Now, if you look at the n equals 6 symmetry, only n equals 6, then you see that this is the final answer. And this has another peculiar behavior, which is this is only invariance under rotation by two sites. If you only rotate by one site, you'll get a minus sign through momentum conservation. So you need to explain why you have this property, and the answer is very simple. You can cook up something that has this property if it has a bifundamental, the gauge indices are bifundamental. So for example, you have two gauge groups and the states are all bifundamental matter, then you'll see that by drawing this double line notation, you see that this is only cyclic invariant under two sites. But this is more, this is actually telling me that I actually have to, besides two cyclic invariants under two sites, under one site you need to get a minus sign. And what that means is that these two gauge groups better have the same Chern-Simon level with the opposite parity. So when you rotate by one, you go k to minus k. So in other words, this is actually known only for probably 5 to 6 years, these theories, but actually you can just already see these structures just by imposing, I want to have an on-show element. I'm not even talking about anything about factorization yet, and this already falls out. Okay, so this is nice. So let's move on to, let's look at the next, the 6-point amplitude. And okay, so we can compute it. So since I mentioned that these theories are actually already known, you can compute it from Feynman diagrams. And so this is the result that you will get from Feynman diagram, which now, okay, this is just some nice answer. So these are the Feynman diagrams that you need to compute. You wouldn't expect that it will get any more simpler than this, because here you're already using on-show variables. So you're not using any polarization vectors that might have gauge dependency. I mean, this is just on-show variables, and that's it. Now, I want to step back and say, what if I try to compute my 6-point S matrix element without using on-show diagram, but using what I said previously? I want to impose locality just directly on my 6-point amplitude, on my procedure. So, okay, this is very nice, but how would I do that? So the idea is, which is actually based on, which was actually done in 4-dimension a long time ago, which is called BCFW mechanism, but in 3-dimension, slightly different. But the idea is essentially the same. You define your amplitude instead of in the usual. You do a small deformation. You deform it into a complex plane. So you look at this as a complex function. And the idea is that in this complex plane, it's going to have simple poles. And the statement of a locality then translates to that these simple poles should correspond to propagator going on shell. So that means the residues of these simple poles, which from unitarity, means that it has to be the product of two lower point amplitudes. When the propagator goes on shell, your bigger S matrix factorizes into two lower point amplitudes. So, but this is all well known. So all this is doing is that this is using the analytic complex variable to really make control of how to apply this. Now, because we're in 3-dimensions, so things are a little bit special. So I have to specify how am I going to do the deformation. So since I'm going to pick two legs, so I'm going to call them leg one and leg two, I'm going to deform them a little bit, but the deform amplitude still has to be an amplitude, so that means momentum conservation has to be preserved. So that means that whatever, so remember this is really just P1 plus P2. After a deformation, it still has to be the same. I cannot alter momentum conservation. So this put a severe constraint on what kind of deformation I have. So if I parameterize my deformation as a matrix that rotates these two, then this condition tells me that this matrix has to be orthogonal. And we can find a solution to this matrix. And that tells us that, for example, we have to introduce this deformation. So all we need to know about this deformation is, first of all, the undeformed is when z is equal to 1. When z equals 1, then we're not deforming anything. So that means my true amplitude is really here when z equals 1. So that means an endpoint amplitude, I'm writing it as an integral over here where the integral is localizing on the z equals 1 pole. But then now I can use contour deformation, and I can deform this contour outside, and now it's picking up all these poles and the complex plane. And these poles are essentially just the residue is essentially just the product of two lower point amplitudes. And there's going to be this is going to be a propagator and some factor here. So all that I want that you should take away from this slide is just that this matrix is going to be, this deformation matrix is actually the orthogonal matrix. So this will come back later. Okay, so let's just do that. So this tells me that my 6 point, I can use to the 2 4 point amplitudes to compute it. So let me compute it. And this is the answer. So it's just a one term answer. So this is my 6 point amplitude. Well, it's actually the sum of two terms here. So in the previous case, we know we did the Feynman diagrams. There was no any gauge symmetry, redundancy there, but we still had a large number of terms. But it turns out that it's actually completely equal to this function, which is very simple. And obviously, we see that why we didn't see this function, why we didn't anticipate it, because there's complex numbers here, and there's really a sum of some complex function and its complex conjugate. So okay, again, once we found this result, even though we understood where it came from imposing locality and unitarity, but we still want to understand, why is it so simple? Is there a way to understand what this formula is telling us about this? Why is this 6 point answer looking so simple? And we can get some hint I've just rewritten these denominators, and we just call them C25, C4, and C63. And you'll realize that actually if you multiply them and the complex conjugate, there are actually nice kinematic invariants, even though it's not obvious by looking at them individually. So it looks like these functions are really solving some quadratic equations. So these things in the denominator is really the solution to some quadratic relation. So can we actually reformulate this to, is this an answer to some other question? So that's what we want to ask. And we already know that this has some properties. For example, this answer has very nice supersymmetry. And with a little bit of thought, we actually realize that actually this answer is equivalent to this integral. So let me explain this. So just consider some 3x6 matrix. And for example, these columns are just a unity, and I have 9 elements here. So now I write this integral. So it's integrated there's 9 here. Sorry, this is supposed to be 9. So they're supposed to integrate over all these 9 elements. Here is the minor of this matrix, the first 3 minors. So this minor, and this one here. And you have some delta function. So this is where the quadratic equation come from. So this matrix has a satisfies this condition. And these are actually giving you the usual giving us the usual momentum conservation after solving these conditions and the supersymmetry. So just do a little bit counting. So there's 6 delta functions here, and there's 6 here, but 3 of them is going to be momentum conservation. So there's really only 3 left. So there's a total of 9 delta functions that are actually, so there's really no integral that you're not really doing any integral. All you're doing is just, your C is actually completely localized by these delta functions, and you just plug it in, and you get the original answer that we have previously. So that is actually the answer to this equation. We can actually make this equation even a little bit more invariant by saying, oh, we don't really need this to be 1. So we can view this as a so-called a Grassmannian, which is the space of planes. So it's, for example, here is a space of 3 planes in a 6 dimension of space, because there's 3, you're essentially 3 vectors here that defines a 3 plane. So you consider this as an integration over the space of 3 planes in 6 dimensions. So let's take k equals 3 here. And so that means that you're going to have a GL3 redundancy here, because you can reshuffle these three vectors and still defining the same plane. But at any rate, the point is that this, so we can actually boost this up to here, and we can see that actually the amplitude is given by some integral over a Grassmannian manifold. But this is not some arbitrary Grassmannian. It's because this Grassmannian has to satisfy this C times C transpose, and this is called orthogonal Grassmannian. So if you're familiar with Nima Arcani's Hamann stories about how n equals 4 is related to Grassmannian, so you see here that this theory that we're looking at, n equals 6, actually just looking at it by imposing locality, the answer you come out, you realize that it's actually an answer to an orthogonal Grassmannian. You're integrating, this theory is actually given by integrating over an orthogonal space of orthogonal Grassmannian. So why is it given, so we want to have an explanation, why is the answer given by this? And there's various arguments. Now, because once you have this nice simple formula, you can discuss what the symmetry of this formula is. And it was realized that this actually, there's an existence of infinite dimensional Yang-Yang symmetry, and which was later also proved to be equivalent to be a dual superconformal symmetry. So this theory has this symmetry, and that's why it can be written in this form. Even though, but notice that these symmetry were not known a priori. It was really going through this and really going imposing, and then the symmetry starts to emerge itself. And by saying this, there's also a side story to this, is that for the n equals 4 story, these symmetry, it also has the corresponding symmetry, but it's also a Yang-Yang, but of a different group. And it has a well understanding in string theory. It's related to the T-duality of ADS5 cross S5 background. But here, so far, people have not really been established what does the symmetry and what is the corresponding symmetry of this on the string theory side of the story. But that's just a side note. Yes?
At least before you go to your second expression, you had some extra delta functions left over. Because you've got more delta functions than integration.
Yeah, so three of these delta functions, you can only use bosonic delta functions to fix things. And three of these delta functions actually, because your lambda is actually imposing, it's imposing momentum conservation.
Oh, yeah.
So there's three momentum conservation. You're in three dimension.
Oh, and that's all you're left over. Yourself.
Yeah, that's all you're left over.
Perfect.
So let me look at this integral in a generic form for arbitrary k. And you notice that this dimension, so by dimension, I count the number of variables here and subtract out the delta functions, the bosonic delta functions. And I'll see that my integral is actually the dimension of this after fixing these delta functions. It's k minus 2, k minus 3 over 2. So here, the number of particle is 2 times k. So k equals 2 means 4 point, k equals 3 means 6 point. So at 4 point and 6 point, there was no integral to be done because this completely fixed it. But as you see, as you go to k equals 4, now you have an integral to do. You have a one-dimension leftover integral, and when you go to higher and higher multiplicity, you have more and more dimension of integrals to do. That's why I actually wrote this not as an equal, but it's actually a subset of this. So what this means is that for higher dimensions, now the integral now needs to localize on this pole. Because here, these are just polynomials, and so they can actually serve as pole to localize your integral. So for example, at 8 points, you have one dimension left, and you can localize on either of these poles. And so, for example, I can draw this diagram, and so this is just the one-dimension space, and you have four minors that you can localize, and each represents a residue. And we noticed that actually each of these residue is one-to-one correspondent to the whole recursion relation that I just mentioned, that you construct higher points from lower points. And the reason that you have two is because if you construct it from recursion diagram, you actually have two diagrams. And so that means you need to the sum of these two poles to give you the correct answer. So now it becomes a little bit unsatisfactory, because now all I'm saying here is that this is just giving some rational functions, and you still have to figure out how to combine them correctly to give the correct amplitude. Of course, once we identify which one of these are matching with the recursion relation, we know how to combine them. But we want to know, we want to really understand these, what are these residue really, what they really are. So I'm going to ask the following question. So now what stage do we have? What we have right now is that we have a bunch of C's, which are solution to solving these delta functions. And if it's beyond k equals 3, then you actually have to satisfy these special conditions where the minors are actually 0. So we want to actually forget about trying to get the amplitude. We just want to look at what these C's really are. So how do we classify the distinct matrix? Now remember these matrix, of course you can say, oh, the entries are different. But remember that these matrix are actually have this GLK symmetry in them. So you have to identify the distinct matrix up to this GLK rotation. And very luckily, this is actually already done by mathematicians. And let me just give a very simple example of how do I identify what's the difference between this matrix and this matrix. What you can do is you can compute the rank of each minor. And you'll see that the rank of each minor for this matrix is different from the rank of minor for this matrix. In other words, the distinct matrices, you can classify them by considering the interdependency of their columns. So for example, here, these two columns are actually linearly dependent on each other, whereas all these columns are, of course, this is a two-dimensional space, so any columns can be spanned by the other two columns, but this is special because this is just directly linearly dependent on that. So in other words, if I give you a matrix C, you can classify it by considering what is the linear interdependency of these. And so this linear dependency of consecutive columns of a Grassmannian is termed pository stratification. This is just this is the mathematical language for that. And this is a well-developed theory by Posnikov. So what we find is that now we have these C's, which are different, are given by these different linear dependencies. So each one have a particular linear dependencies. And so that tells us that this recursion that I just developed is actually building a particular stratification, a particular set of linear dependency. So now I'm actually going even more formal. I'm going away from physics now, but you'll see that it actually is going to give a very big implication in the very end. So I want to understand what are these particular stratifications that I'm building up in this recursion, which is required by imposing locality. So let me just go back. So in order to do this, I want to simplify my construction dramatically. So let me just go back to the original four-point amplitude, which is now written in this Grassmannian form. So it's integrated over GL2 in Grassmannian. So you see that there's a delta function. These are really nice because these are really linear delta functions. They're just linear equations, but this is a quadratic equation. So I want to solve this quadratic equation. So I can choose a variable and then solve it. So now this equation is equivalent to this, where actually I solved this quadratic equation. So now it's just given in terms of a sine and cosine. This is a solution. And so this is another representation of my four-point amplitude. And before I go on, you'll notice that this four-point amplitude has two singularity. You can actually read off the singularity. One is whether when sine is equal to 0, and one is when cosine is equal to 0. And when one is, since when, for example, when sine is equal to 0, then this just becomes, this is 0 and this is just 1, then that means that these two are linearly dependent. And because this is inside a delta function, it is forcing the lambda of this column to be proportional to lambda of this column. That's the singularity that corresponds to beta goes to 0. What does that mean? This is actually just the soft singularity. Because that means that you have a four-point amplitude, and what you have is you have two incoming lines that are becoming completely linear with each other. And so there's a soft exchange between them. And similarly, when cosine equals 0, this corresponds to the other soft singularity. So this is an important point, because now you see that the boundaries, the singularity of your Grassmannian, because this corresponds to the boundary when two becomes collinear, is directly physical singularities. So this will be also true in higher point diagrams. So now we can do more complicated things. So for example, now in the original case, I mentioned that, for example, when you're going on local poles, it factorizes into two lower point amplitudes. This factorized means that you have to multiply two lower point amplitudes together, and then solving all the momentum conservation condition and so on and so forth. Now it's just very simple. All you're doing, because each of these four-point amplitudes is just this kind of integral, and they're just a set of linear equations. So combining them is just combining linear equations into some bigger, higher dimensional integral. So this is a one-dimensional integral. So that means if you multiply four-point tree-amplitude, it becomes a two-dimensional integral. And then you have some delta functions again, which is the result of combining your delta functions. So now if I want to do the recursion, I need to shift two legs. And so these two legs need to be deformed. And this is actually given, so this is giving you the residue, which is actually the 2 4-points. But the value added at a particular point, which is this Gaussian shell. And this is actually exactly equivalent to this diagram. And the reason is very simple. Remember, and when I was discussing about the recursion, I was mentioning that this deformation, you have to deform it by an orthogonal matrix. R times R transpose is 1. This is exactly the orthogonal matrix that you're imposing, that is the correct deformation. So if I add this vertex here, this vertex will have this bosonic delta function that is forcing this original, these two legs here, to be deformed by this rotation matrix. So this is actually a 6-point amplitude diagram. So now we see that actually you can use this. Now I can just recast everything diagrammatically. So I'm going back. This is my 4-point amplitude. It's given by this integral. Now I'm just writing in a nice form. It's actually written as a D log form with this matrix. The 6-point amplitude is now a three-dimension integral with some Jacobian factor and with some particular C matrix, which actually you can just compute it directly, and it's given by this. So this is another representation of my 6-point amplitude. But now it's just completely represented as diagram. You can do this further. You can compute the 8-point amplitude, and this is how the 8-point amplitude looks diagrammatically. So now all the entire amplitude is just gluing together these fundamental vertex and summing them together. Now we can count the dimension of each diagram. So this is 1 dimension, this is 3 dimension, this is 5 dimension. And you'll notice that all these dimensions exactly matches the degree of delta functions that you have, which fixes. So that means that this is giving you a rational function. Okay, so now I want to answer what is so special, going back to an answer. So what is so special about the C matrix that we're building from these diagrams? It turns out that if you do an analytic continuation, if I take all the even columns, an analytic continuation with an I, then what you find is that the minor of the resulting matrix is all positive for the range of theta going from 0 to pi over 2. So this is not trivial, because you can just construct arbitrary matrix which satisfy this orthogonal condition. And generically, this is never true, although it's not always true, that you'll find that some will be negative, some will be positive. But the diagrams that are computed from this recursion relation have this property that it's always positive. And this is actually a well-defined mathematical property of this Grassmannian. So this is you term the positive orthogonal Grassmannian. Okay, so I've identified that it is a positive orthogonal Grassmannian, but so what? Well, it turns out that a positive orthogonal Grassmannian is actually a polytope. So what do I mean by a polytope? So remember that this is a 6-point amplitude. So this is a 3-dimension integral. So in 3-dimension integral, that means that you have 3 singularities. You can go to 1 singularity. So if you go to 1 singularity, then these are the 3 possible singularities. But on these singularities, they can also have their own singularity. For example, you remember that each vertex represents a 1-dimension integral, so they can also have their own singularity. So if you go to their singularity, then there's actually a total of 6 singularities. They also have their singularity. You can go all the way down, because this is a 3-dimension integral, that means you have 3 layers of singularity. The last layer is really just 5. There's 5 singularities. Now, if you add up using this formula, so a polytope has a feature that let me just use an example. So let's consider a simplex. Well, actually, the stupidest thing is I can start with an n-gon. So for an n-gon, starting from 1, the top one is 2 dimensions. So there's one top one, which is 2 dimensions, which is -1, 2. So this is the dimension of the cell that I have. Now the next one, the boundary of this, there's n of these 1-dimension boundaries. So that means you add n minus 1, 1. And then the singularity of these each boundaries are the points. So there's also n of them. So you have you plus n minus 1 to the 0. And this gives you 1. for any n-gon. You can try the same thing for simplices. So now the top thing is 1 times minus 1 to the 3, because this is a three-dimension object. The second one is 4, because it's the four faces of the simplex. And then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6. Is that correct? 6. Yes. Then you have 6 boundaries, these lines. And finally, you have 4 points. So this is minus 1 plus 4 minus 6 plus 4. And so this is 1. So you see that all polytopes have this feature. The boundary of the, you just count their boundaries and their dimensions, and they always add up to 1. So now let's go back to the 6-point amplitude. You can actually see that this actually exactly. So there's 1, there's 3, there's 6, and then there's 5. And you see that this is 1. You can look at any of these diagrams that is computed from this recursion, and you see that all of these diagrams all have the same property, that they all just have the combinatorics of a polytope.
I'm sorry, what is the definition of a polytope other than this condition?
So and this condition is also computing the Euler characteristic, right? So essentially, it's just that it's topologically equivalent to a ball.
So it's just a collection of points connected by lines?
You're looking at the boundary, so you just go to the, so the number of boundaries that you have in each dimension. So, a polytope.
The number of boundaries of what? How do I construct the thing that I start with?
What are the rules?
Is it a simplex?
Or do you start with a simplex?
No, you don't have to be a simplex. I can start with a box, right? You can do the same counting for a box. You start with the box. It has how many number of faces? It's how many? It's first of all, what's the dimension of its volume? Then you count how many faces you have.
I'm trying to get a much simpler concept than that. What are the set of rules for the objects that we're going to start counting on? How do I construct that?
So you have an object and you say, what is the dimension of this object? That's fine. And once you have the dimension, you can ask, what is the boundary of this object? Which in here we have
the object itself is points connected by line segments?
No, it's some this.
So you start with a higher dimensional ball.
Yeah.
And you just sort of find some discretization of its boundary. Right?
Yeah. It's not a point. It's just it's a volume essentially.
Another way to say it is take a set of points in Zn, centered or
centered points in
Zn.
Zn.
And then take the convex hull of this set of points. So. I don't have a precise definition of convex hull, but imagine connecting. Imagine that they were on they were points on a sphere, like Gary was saying. Then you were sort of connecting their interiors. But then you can imagine splitting up on the faces, splitting these faces up into various triangles, and there's a notion of triangulating a polytope. So. It doesn't help if I don't give you a definition of convex hull, but.
All right. I think the answer is there's no simple answer.
But as I mentioned previously, that each of these, so going back to these diagrams, each of these singularity of these diagrams actually reflects in some singularity of your final answer. So in the previous 4-point case, we've found that the singularity of the diagram actually represents the opening up of these vertex, which is actually this soft singularity. So it turns out that in higher points, if I go to 8 points, you can imagine you have these diagrams. Now the singularities are more complicated. So I'm not going to draw the diagram. So I'm just these are just the list of the singularities. But the important point is that it is the multiplicity, and you see it always adds up to 1. So using the recursion and representing this recursion as this building up of these fundamental vertices, you see that what you're building up is essentially each vertex is equivalent to a polytope. It has the same feature. And so we want to ask, what is the boundary of these polytopes? And we see in the very simple case, the boundary was actually physical singularity. It is reflected as this physical singularity of your amplitude. But for higher points, it turns out that some singularities are physical, but some aren't. They are spurious singularity. But that is precisely what the recursion is giving you. The recursions give you multiple terms. Each of them is a polytope. Each of them has physical and unphysical boundaries. And they add up such that the unphysical boundary always cancel. And you are left with only physical boundaries. So you can actually see this if you if I draw the 8-point diagram, you can analyze all the boundary. It always cancels and pair the unphysical ones. And the ones that don't cancel is always physical boundary. So since I'm running this, I'm just going to go real quick. So
excuse me, all of this is based on 6 supersymmetries in 3 dimensions?
Yes, so this is this particular. But you can also reduce, so now once we establish for the 6 supersymmetry, now we can just push this down because this is tree level, you can just directly reduce down to lower supersymmetry by Suzy truncation. It'll always have the same property because these are just rational functions. And, right. So, okay, so if I want to give a real brief summary, so basically what we have here is that we have, if you actually find that you actually efficiently impose locality unitarity, we actually found the new symmetries about the theories that we didn't know about before. And turns out that the elementary building blocks of the scattering amplitude is actually simply a polytope in nature. And the amplitude is really a bigger polytope that has only physical boundary.
That saying you can assemble the smaller ones, that's what you mean by the boundaries canceling?
Yes, exactly. So there will be 2 boundaries that are essential, and because you notice that we have these D log thing that are actually wedge products. So the way that they're coming together is that they have a minus sign for the unphysical boundaries. So of course we can ask multiple questions. So okay, it's identified with a polytope, but there's a question about, so what is this rational function is computing? It has the same singularity. So one quantity of this polytope is being computed. Now, for certain cases, for n=4, where this is also established, so Nima has been claiming that this actually is, for particular cases, explicitly at 4-point, he's been able to say, really map that this quantity is really the volume of the polytope. But we believe that that for 3 dimensions, it's going to be something slightly different. And for reason that actually will be mentioned in here. But obviously, you can also push this to loop level. And so, for example, this would be the one loop diagram, one loop 4-point diagram. But the reason I say that it's slightly different in 3 dimensions is because of the following. In 3 dimensions, your kinematics is really a non-trivial topology. So I'm talking about 3 dimension massless kinematic. So essentially, it's equivalent to points on a circle. Because of the massless condition. You can just project it as a point on the circle. And so we have a particular ordering because we're considering called an ordered amplitude. So as we know that we can actually label, we can just successfully add 2 pi such that it's ordered on the circle. Now, if 2 of these points starts crossing each other, these are topologically inequivalent. Because they have different winding numbers. You can consistently define winding number. Actually, this actually appears in the amplitude. So actually, if we compute the amplitude in 3 dimensions, and you compute to, for example, a 1 loop, then you'll notice that your answer is going to have sine functions. So it has a discontinuity, and this sine function is switched from 0 to 1 precisely when the winding number starts crossing each other. So in other words, the kinematic is not a simple, it's not like in 4 dimension where it's essentially R4. Here, this is really a non-trivial topology. So that's why the belief that whatever this quantity is computing, it has to be something that is more intricate than the 4 dimension story. Okay, so this is really 4 particular theory, and I began my talk where I wanted to discuss general theories. So if I want to discuss general theory, so remember what I did. I just start with using symmetry to fix my lower point, and then I start iteratively construct my higher points. I find all these nice things. But we know that there's theories that a lower point is perfectly fine, which means that, or in other words, a tree level 3-point amplitude is perfectly fine. But we know that it's sick at loop level, and these are the presence of gauge anomalies. So in principle, because remember, I'm trying to impose locality and unitarity, and so where if I started with something that is chiral, for example, a chiral gauge theory, how do I find that this theory is sick? And if I able to find it, what would this Poe procedure, is this going to ship, tell me anything new? So we're going to do in the last 10, I'll try to do in 15 minutes, let's try to do an exercise and try to answer this question. Because now we know how to compute answers, so we just go ahead and compute the answer and see what's wrong about the answer. So I'm going to use a 4.1 loop amplitude as an example. Okay, so in order to simplify my task, I'm going to represent my 4-point, you can always do this, so for any theory, you can represent your 4-point amplitude as a linear combination of scalar integrals. So this is a scalar box, scalar triangles with S and T channels, and a scalar bubble, which is just a bubble integral, and some rational terms. So these coefficients is what's determined. Different theories will have different coefficients. There's a procedure of doing that. So for different theories, I'm going to analyze what the coefficients are. Okay, so now I want to look at a fermion coupled to a gauge field. So let's compute the coefficient. So in order to be able to do chiral fermions, I'm going to compute the two helicity separately. So you remember, how do we compute these integrals? How do we compute these coefficients? We use unitarity cuts. We cut the amplitude open, and then we compute. These are just tree-level processes, and when you stick them in, and it tells you what the coefficient in front of that amplitude is. So you see there's two boxes, two triangles, and two bubbles. That's because there's two different chiralities rotating inside. So I'm separating them. Okay, so these are my answers. So this is just, if you actually do the computation, if each of these external layers are a gluon, and you compute chiral fermions, and then this is just your answer. Okay, so let's first go with the safe thing, which is we know that this everything should be fine. So let's see the parity even, because that's the non-chiral theory is going to give you something that is parity even. So that means that you're adding the two together. So this is your integrated result. Okay, so this is fine. But you notice that there's actually some weird things about this integrator. You see that there's these u sitting in the denominator. Why do I say this is weird? Because remember, we're looking at a color-ordered amplitude, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, if you look at u, this corresponds to some factorization channel that is p1 and p3, which is not really a physical channel from this point of view, because everything is ordered. So how can 1 and 3 come in and start producing a particle? So this is really an illegal channel sitting inside my amplitude. Because this is not physical, that better means that if I look at the residue of this pole, it better be 0. Otherwise, my amplitude doesn't satisfy. It doesn't satisfy the required locality because I have a non-local pole. So if you look at this u equals 0 limit, you see that indeed it still has some non-trivial residue on top of it. So this answer is wrong. So what happened? Well, remember that that I said that the answer can be recast in this integral plus r, which is a rational term. Now, what rational term means that it doesn't have cuts. So unitarity cut cannot detect anything of your amplitude that has rational term. But then you can ask, okay, but if I do unitarity cut, I impose something, I construct something, it's unitary. So what might go wrong? We've seen that what went wrong is even though it's unitary, it violates locality because it has these non-local pole. So the presence of rational terms is precisely to cancel this non-locality. So you can cook up a rational term just by looking at the symmetry of this amplitude. And this rational term, you'll see that on the u equals 0, it precisely cancels these. So that means your final answer should be this rational term plus these cut constructible pieces. And indeed, this is exactly what this amplitude was computed in the 90s, and using Feynman diagrams. But so this plus this is the correct answer for your amplitude. Okay, so now let's look at parity odd. Let's see what happens. So parity odd means that you're taking the two combinations and putting a minus sign in between it. And this is the final integrated result. Okay, again, we see that there's these spurious pole. We can analyze the u equals 0 limit, and we see that it has a non-trivial residue. But that's fine, we can add rational terms. The rational term is uniquely determined by the symmetry and the requirement that it has to cancel this. And this is the rational term that is required to cancel this non-local pole. Okay, so this is fine. But this is just writing it in a different form. So what is wrong here? Now, recall that this A tree is a tree factor. It has a propagator in it, which is actually, if I write it in this form, you see that it's an S and T channel. So even though there's a U channel factorization, the U channel, the non-local factorization is actually now no longer there, there's actually a good local factorization pole. You've actually introduced a local factorization pole now, an S and T. So that means that in your one-loop amplitude, you're seeing a new factorization pole, which better have a good explanation, which means that the residue, in order for it to be consistent with unitarity, the residue better have a well understanding of what the residue is. You can use dimension analysis, and you'll find that the residue can only be spin 1. But we know that the only consistent spin, because this is a 4-point, so it can only factorize into a 3-point. We know the only consistent spin 1-amp 3-point interaction is actually just the usual Yang-Mills 3-point interaction, which does not receive correction at one loop. So there's no consistent answer to what this factorization residue is, because there's nothing for it to factorize. If you look back at the parity even case, you see why this wasn't a problem. You see, when this was supposed to be multiplied by an A tree. So even though there's pole from the tree level, but on the pole, because there's actually S and T, it kills. There's no residue there. So here, in order for the parity even case, in order to fix up your non-locality, you didn't introduce anything new. But for parity odd, trying to fix up your non-local U pole, you actually start introducing new factorization pole, which you cannot explain.
If a product S T times, does anything give you a product of S times T times U, which you normally get sums, even if you had normally you'd have a 1 over S plus a 1 over T plus a 1 over U from the various channels. Can anything ever give you that product?
Okay, good. Exactly. This is what I'm going to get. So this is exactly the next slide. But here you see already there's a problem. I'm going to be worried about this S and T. But exactly, the other channels might also have this term as well. So might they cancel? But remember, the other channels have different color ordering, so they're multiplying by different gauge group structure. So the only other channel that has this is something that has an inverted trace factor. So indeed, there's two channels that that has this particular term. So if this is zero, then we're free. And what is this condition? You can rewrite this condition in terms of DFABC, and this is just, you can just permute, and then you can rewrite it as this linear combination. And you see that the condition that this is zero is precisely your box and your non-abelian box anomaly condition. So as you see, by imposing locality, by consistently imposing locality in unitary, we see that for parity odd, we find that there's an inconsistency. And the only way that inconsistency can be avoided is precisely this condition. Okay, so this is just, I have a prelude, so that means there's something more behind it.
Is this result in the two published works you mentioned at the beginning, or is this in the one to come?
Oh, this is in the one that I already published. So now let's go, we can do higher dimensions. Actually, this, you can do this for any even dimensions. Well, okay, I'll mention why only even dimension will have problems. So now I'm not going to go through the procedure. It's again the same thing. You just, again, use unitarity cuts to compute your integral coefficients. So for six dimension, these are the integral coefficients. I just list them here for completeness. So again, and then you integrate the integral. So again, we can look at the factorization channels. So again, if you look at the U equals 0, T equals 0, S, it has non-trivial factorization poles. It always, so for, if we look at U equals 0, it behaves like this. So it has a non-trivial residue sitting on the U factorization joint. So again, if you have a residue, then you better have an explanation for what this is. But of course, you're already seeing, because now I've collected everything together, that it's actually a symmetric trace. So if your gauge theory has the symmetric trace is actually 0, then all these are never there, and you're perfectly fine. So you're free of any inconsistency if your symmetric trace is 0. But of course, we can do even more. So what if your symmetric trace factorizes into some other representation? So let's say the symmetric trace is not 0, but if in some other representation, A equals 0, that means that it's factorized. Can I now interpret this U factorization channel as implying some new factorization, some new particle that is propagating? Well, not exactly. Why? Because if I look at the U equals 0 thing, then the symmetric trace is going to factorize to all of these possibilities. Mm-hmm. But U means that you have 3 coming in creating a particle. So this is perfectly fine for this guy. But this is not fine for these two. These two shouldn't have any U channel poles. So what do? Again, we add rational terms to cure things. So the rational term that you actually need to add is you add a rational term that has particularly this particular form. And what you find after adding this rational perm is that now your amplitude on each of the factorization pole only has a double trace factor, that the correct double trace factor. And indeed, this is the previous cut constructible part plus this rational part is the complete answer. And furthermore, we can ask what is actually propagating on this pole. And again, you can go through dimension analysis and you could go through little group analysis. You'll immediately see that now you have a two form. So in other words, you see what you discover is that starting from a chiral theory, your spectrum requires you for the consistency of your one loop answer, the spectrum requires you to have a new particle in your spectrum, and that's the Green-Schwarz two form. It's just kind of, you don't need to go through research string theory, and this is just what it's telling you by this analysis. And as you see, all the anomaly cancellation conditions just essentially drops out. But what I would like to point out is actually, I want to look at, this is actually quite interesting, what is this rational term from the Feynman diagram computation point of view? It's also actually pretty interesting. Because if I compute the Feynman diagram, I'm going to get a rational, so I want to answer what these are. So you're going to, from the Feynman diagram, you're also going to get some rational term, which takes this form. And I call this anomaly, because this is precisely where the anomaly occurs. Well, you can understand the anomaly must come from some rational term because the anomaly is rational. But you can see that if I do a Ward identity, I replace epsilon 1 by k1, this is going to give me some non-trivial 1 plus 1 plus 1. Well, actually, 1 half plus 1 half plus 1 half. So this is not gauge invariant. So this is a part of your answer that is not gauge invariant. So now we need the Green-Schwarz mechanism. So what the Green-Schwarz for particular, because it cannot just add everything, because the Green-Schwarz contribution actually has a particular channel depending on the two trace factors. So what the Green-Schwarz contribution is doing is actually just modifying this little thing here to be minus 2. Such that under a gauge variation, this is 0. So this is how Green-Schwarz mechanism cancels your anomaly. But what's important is that it's not the amplitude that is 0. It's the gauge invariant, it's the gauge variation that is 0. So that means that there's a remnant, which is this object, that actually the amplitude knows that there was an anomaly cancellation that actually happened. And this rational term is precisely the term that we just found previously by doing this gauge invariant combination. So this is just a six-dimension story. You can also push to 8-dimension and 10-dimension, exactly the same things occurs. So, okay, good, I'm on time. So in other words, there's really no gauge anomaly per se. It's really a contradiction between imposing unitarity on locality. But I think what is good about this approach is really that it's a very precise statement about what's going wrong. It has nothing to do with how you continue your, because of regularization, whether your regularization method is good or bad, how do you continue your chiral theory to extra dimension in order to do regularization. This is just physical. I impose unitarity, I impose locality, and that's my answer. And there's just something wrong. I don't care whichever way you do your regularization, this is just essentially what is wrong. And you can push this to many other, so you can also understand why, another way of understanding why, where anomalies are termed, occurs, because actually these rational terms can only appear for d equals even dimensions. And this is because, why does amplitude have rational terms at one loop? And that's because a particular ultraviolet divergence cancel with epsilon order terms, if we want to use a traditional Feynman diagram analysis point of view. And ultraviolet divergence only occurs in integer dimensions, in even dimensions at one loop. So this is the reason why these rational terms appear only at one loop. So something can only be wrong when there's a rational term, and that's why these are only potential dangers for d equals even. You can do the same analysis, you can see for each dimension, which is the first point it can start appearing using the same analysis. Now, so this should be come out soon, that you can also apply this to gravitation and mixed anomalies. Exactly the same thing. The story is going to be slightly different because, of course, the gravity already have the two form in your gravity. But what's different this time is that it's actually telling you that even though you already know there's a two form, but the interactions of the two forms actually this factorization tells you you have some B. For example, your three form potential needs to have a Chern-Simon term, and so on and so forth. The interaction, it tells you that you have new interactions. And more importantly, you can actually apply this to chiral two forms in chiral gravity in six dimensions. So remember that the standard statement is that there's no Lorentz invariant action for a chiral two form. And so that's why you might have gauge anomalies, and because of this non-Lorentz intersection. But of course, that's one of the ways of stating why two chiral two forms can be anomalous. But here, again, there's no action involved. We're just using symmetries and unitarity and locality. And this tells us, again, you have this anomaly condition. OK, I think this is probably the end of my second. Yes, so this is the end of my talk. So it's really separated into two. So in the first part, I discussed how to impose this, and we find new symmetries and new structures that we didn't know about before. In the second part of my talk, I discuss how to use this to understand some old problems that makes the problem actually more sharper. So thank you very much.
So for the second half of your story, how much supersymmetry do you need?
Oh, there's no supersymmetry.
You don't need any supersymmetry.
Yeah, this is just... Yeah, this is just a fermion with either a gauge field or a fermion with, and then for these cases we consider just a fermion with graviton or just a two form with the graviton, all separated.
I see. And you put in that because you put in what the physical particles are.
Yeah. Eventually. So that's essentially you define what your asymptotic state is. And the tree amplitudes that are entering the unitarity cuts are all fixed by symmetry arguments. So there's really no wiggling room in.
So if we just did a U1 theory in four dimensions, you could see that you could have a 1 charge 2 and 8 charge minus 1. You cancel the kernel anomaly.
Well, I mean, once you have an anomaly, then you can just see how many different charges. I mean, we have a particular term there.
Right.
So the different contributions, then you're just adding different copies, either with a minus or a plus, because that term is depending on your coupling. So that's essentially, yeah.
So if you were just going to consider a scalar theory,
you can do this. Yeah.
That you have, you don't start with an action, so there are lots of possible, potentials, right, or interactions. Like
right.
Invert.
Right.
You just use your general rules. Is it just much less constraints?
Exactly.
Now?
Yeah.
It's just a lot of free, undetermined parameters.
Yes, essentially. Yeah. So, well, it depends on which part of my story. So, for example, what?
Oh, okay. Scattering amplitude, structure of the scattering amplitude.
Yes. So this is usually rephrased in the terms of, because in this, as I mentioned, that you're deform. So the way that you're employing localities is you're deforming your amplitude into complex plane and you're using the pole. There's a caveat in that which I didn't mention, which is that in order to do this, you better have no pole and infinity. So you have to have an argument for why there's no pole infinity. And usually for spin one and various spins, you have an argument for why there's a no pole infinity. But for scalar, you don't have that argument.
I see.
So that's essentially where the freedom, where that construction breaks down.
Maybe I missed something, but normally you talk about anomalies as you go in dimension, you have to consider higher point functions.
Right.
And you were able to consider both the four point function for both?
No. For four, obviously, anomaly already appears at 3-point function in four dimension.
It was just hidden in the 4-point, right?
Yeah, it was hidden in the 4-point. Right, so for the higher dimension.
The same one, yeah.
Yeah, so for higher dimensions, I'm looking at the 5-point and the 6-point, yeah. Okay, I guess. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks.